off stage and on the air. Performance number 732. I am Lisa Sheps, and currently I'm running solo today. Our guest host, Brian Cheswick, should be here soon. You are listening to us on KOOP HD1 HD3. We stream this live at koop.org. If you are in Austin or anywhere else, stick around. We'll be right back.
Hurry, hurry, step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cup. Step right up. Feast your eyes on the wonders of this world. Oh, yeah.
Kiss today goodbye.
It is Wednesday, August 9th, 2023. On the show today, we have Ground Floor Theater and their show, Jenna and the Whale. And of course, we will have lively discussions of the world of theater in Austin, New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Miami. Don't go away. Love is, I don't know what they say in Chorus Line. So we are here, and I was at this point going to say, welcome Brian Cheswick to the show, but Brian is unable to make it for unforeseen reasons. So we're just going to pretend he's here. There is an empty microphone. We're going to take a picture of it so that he knows that he was missed. Brian Cheswick was set to be my guest co-host. I do have to just say that I don't know. I think that listeners of mine know that he is the artistic director of Deaf Austin Theater. Of which I've worked with several times, and they are bringing a fully American Sign Language version of the Laramie Project to Ground Floor Theater next month. So we'll be talking to them later, but that's an amazing thing. They spoke and got direct permission from Moises Kaufman and the whole brood over at the Laramie Project people. So we're looking forward to that. And we were also looking forward to having Brian talk to us about his things that he did in New York. And one of them is he went to see Parade, which just closed. But we have other people that are going to act as my co-host here today. And we have returning for her like fourth or fifth time is Tony Knight. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Lisa.
It's so good to see you again.
It's wonderful.
I feel like I haven't seen you in a long time.
Minutes have passed.
And then direct from Miami, we have playwrights extraordinaire, Vanessa Garcia. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi.
Welcome to Ground Floor. Welcome to Offstage and On the Air.
Thank you.
And Jake Klein.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Oh, good. Thanks for being on the show. That's it for today. No, teasing. So we played Chorus Line, and the reason why I played that is a little thing happened. You know, we hear about these things every now and then, but this one was an interesting thing. And we talk about representation and stuff like that. And there was a theater in, oh my God, Connecticut. I'm trying to turn on my computer. I can't figure out how to do it, which will have it. But they were doing a production of Chorus Line, and they, Concord Theatricals, pulled the rights to do it. Did you hear about this, Tony? You're nodding.
I am looking it up. because I was like, what's it going to be? And wow, the headline alone was.
Yeah. So this was at the Bradley Playhouse in Putnam, Connecticut. So they evidently, so we talk about quite often, especially since the pandemic and the George Floyd and the We See You White Theater list of demands, that representation is really important, and that if there's a role written for a black person, let's say, that a black person should play that role. And there has we talked last week about oh my God, I got to remember what it was, but it was like I forgot what it was, but it was some like traditional black show that there was a white version of, they cast white actors in it. But this case, the theater tried to cast a black person. They said they were unable to do it. I find that, first of all, a little highly suspect. Mm-hmm. That in a city in the Northeast, I don't know exactly where in Connecticut Putnam is, but if it's anywhere near New York City, there's a plethora of actors. But instead of putting a white person in the role of Richie, which is written for a black actor, they decided to just cut the role from the show.
Oh.
I know. Wow. First of all, what do y'all think of that in general? What does that bring up for y'all?
Wow.
I mean, it's not anything, like, you very much surprised me when you said that was the way they went. Oh, couldn't cast it. So, you know. Now we don't have that role.
That is the way they went. And I should say that I learned about this. There's a blog called The Onstage Blog written by Christopher Peterson. And he is unrelentingly angry at this theater company and really challenging them on what they're saying. Their statement said, Concord Theatricals, who holds the rights, mm-hmm. heard about this and they pulled the rights. Right. Like, I think shortly before they were going to go up. And their statement says, quote, "It is with regret. Yeah, I feel like I'm in Blazing Saddles. It is with regret that we must announce the cancellation of our production of A Chorus Line scheduled for August 4th through 13th, which would be right now. Due to an unfortunate miscommunication by a hardworking and committed volunteer, the rights holder has chosen to revoke our rights to the show. A terrible mistake was made without malice or intent. We wish to formally apologize to Concord Theatricals for the error and provide assurance that steps are being put into place to ensure that something like this can never happen again," etc. But according to Christopher Peterson, who did a lot of research, they had been searching for the character of Richie and another character, a white character, for a long, long, long time. But their public social media posts mm-hmm. that were calling out for things, they kept calling out for the white actor, but they stopped early calling out for Richie.
Wow.
According to him. Wow. So he's being very critical of the company and then also calling them out for passing the buck to a volunteer, a well-meaning volunteer.
That's what I was going to say. They're blaming all of this on a volunteer?
Yeah. Interesting, right?
Yeah, it's like blame the intern.
Yeah, blame the intern.
I love that you're boosting the signal on this because, I mean, their whole like, oh, this terrible mistake was made and we're sorry and we've put steps in place to never do it again. It's so late to have those steps in place. Like, how right. could it be the case?
I will say we are only getting one side of the story. Mm-hmm. I didn't spend a lot of time looking at the other side, but so it sounds like by what he's putting in there, and he actually did a fair amount of research and he found social media posts that were taken down, yeah. and he got screenshots of them somehow.
The word miscommunication is interesting too, because what was being communicated and what did this volunteer not understand?
Yeah. Exactly. And, we have gone through, the Ground Floor Theater has gone through this same thing and making sure that representation, mm-hmm. we're currently searching for an actor we're having trouble finding. So we're doing a national search and we're going to pay to fly someone in to make sure yeah. we get the right representation
and that's,
on stage.
Yeah, and that's the point, right? I mean, the actors that are hard to find in certain communities, there's a reason why they're hard to find in those communities. So uh-huh. those channels and the access channels and the communication between theaters and certain neighborhoods, communities, groups, etc. I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah.
So you have to just on the writing side, I'm like, well, just basic, you can't do that. You can't cut a person.
Well, they
out.
Also said that they had originally, in one of the original posts in there, said they had gotten permission from the publisher. But I can't imagine. First of all, I deal a lot with Concord Theatricals. Their first answer is always no, okay. if you want to do anything that's not standard. But I can't imagine that they would give permission to cut any character, much less a character of color.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then, so clearly, they did not. I would find it hard. Well, they didn't have permission because Concord Theatricals heard about it and then contacted them to revoke their rights.
I wonder if they heard about it from this blog.
I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
I think the blog happened after. But who knows? So we did have a Broadway opening this week, which we talked about on last week's show, because I think they opened on Thursday. Our show is on Wednesdays. And of course, I'm talking about Back to the Future. I'm searching for my thing, the actual, there it is. I found it. So Back to the Future, which Nicole saw a preview of in New York and loved it. And she was very excited about the DeLorean. And sure enough, when you read the reviews, it seems to be all about the DeLorean. Did they like it? The review aggregator had 7-Eleven, 16 reviews. 4 were positive, 5 were mixed, and 7 were negative. So mixed all around, but basically not all that good. And the New York Times, which is the one I read, was negative.
Oh.
This stars, oh my God, I lost his name, Roger Bart as Doc Brown, and Casey Likes is Marty McFly. And they said that, you know, you're making a musical out of a movie, which is not unheard of these days, but they said they didn't really do a good job of bringing anything extra, mm-hmm. or even following what the cleverness of the movie. And the movie did what in a couple of hours. They didn't have enough time to fill in the blanks. And if you're a Back to the Future fan, and are y'all a Back to the Future fans?
I remember seeing it in the theater.
I'm a fan.
Yeah,
but I mean, if you go back and they really dotted their T's, mm-hmm. because, you know, all the little things down to the Twin Pines turning into the Lone Pine Mall, back to the Twin Pines Mall. I just thought that was funny. So they did have a DeLorean DMC and a life-size replica, which everybody loves. Jesse Green from The Times said, quote, "The crafty illusions combining mechanical action, busy productions, and a lot of distraction with fog, lights, and sound. Alas, that also describes the rest of the show," directed by John Rando.
Yikes.
So he did not no. like it. This is, I'll show everybody here a little picture of it.
At the DeLorean.
At the DeLorean. So he did not like the music. He says, "Still, you might hope that something in the musical, for instance, the music, would change the way the material lands. It doesn't." He also says, "The inventiveness and surprise of the climactic sequence. We see Doc climbing the crucial clock tower in a hilariously fake layering of live action behind a scrim and animation projected onto it. Makes the show obsessive concern with faithfulness elsewhere feel like a cheap compromise. And yet, it's not really faithful. The movie is carefully balanced in tone. The musical is dialed up, unfortunately, to 88 miles per hour."
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sick
so,
burn.
Not, okay. Yeah, he doesn't like it. Now, I don't always agree with Jesse Green, but still, he called the material shallow. He didn't like it.
Well, I'm going to strike that right off my non-existent
well,
Broadway
show. Well, I
don't
shows. Know. And yeah, I will say that the person closest to us here at Offstage on the Air, Nicole Shiro, really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, it sounds to
you
me like...
You never know.
Yeah.
It sounds like they need to bring Crispin Glover in for the dose yeah. of oh, oddness that he brings to everything he does.
I agree. I mean, those actors made those characters kind of iconic.
Yeah.
And they did mention... oh my God! I forgot the guy who Doc Brown was.
Christopher Lloyd.
Christopher Lloyd. Uh-huh. Yeah, this is my 65-year-old addled brain. They did talk about a reference between Christopher Lloyd and Roger Bart, and not in the most complimentary way. The only other review I'll say here is Brittany Samuel of Broadway News said that it had isolated quirks and thrilling set. Let's do that over again. Said, "Isolated quirks and thrilling theatrics land Back to the Future a rank above most blockbusters to Broadway adaptations. Nostalgic 80s charm mingled with 2023 theatrical capability is a winning combination." So clearly she liked it.
All right.
Yeah. I would go see it if I got
yeah,
a free ticket.
Yeah, I would go see it too.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's go. We can get the next flight out.
Yeah.
All right, so that's Back to the Future. And then, you know, I think this will be interesting to all of us because I saw in the New York Times today that the I got to get the right one here because it didn't print very well. It's the wide world of puppetry is landing in New York with the Puppet Fringe Festival, which I didn't even know existed.
It's so fringe, you didn't even know it was there.
I didn't.
Way out.
But this article that you can see on Offstage and On the Air has a bunch of pictures of some of these puppets.
Oh, that's cool.
I'm showing them a picture. It looks like a donkey, but there's so much incredible stuff happening with puppeteering these days. And, of course, I chose the wrong article that didn't print everything. So here we go. Has anybody seen... I always go back to War Horse.
No.
Did anybody see War Horse?
I've seen it. I saw it in Miami.
Saw it in Miami? We saw in a proscenium situation, uh-huh. Right?
Yep.
Yeah. I saw it twice. I saw it here in the proscenium situation, but I saw it at Lincoln Center at the Beaumont, which is a round thrust, and the horses actually came from the back of the house, through the house and onto the stage. Truly amazing.
Wow.
But that was one of the first times that I... Because I'm not... You know... I'm a little on the bubble about whether I like to go watch like puppetry or not. Mm-hmm. But I really appreciate the art form.
Yeah.
So what y'all think of War Horse?
I don't remember. I just remember the spectacle of it. And then I can't remember the production. Was it at New Theater?
It was at the Arch Center, the one I saw.
Oh, the one I saw was at, I think it was at New Theater.
It was, I don't know if it was the official Broadway tour.
Okay.
But I remember loving it. I found it very moving.
Yeah, me too.
And I grew up around horses too, so they seem to have captured all of that.
I used to horse around. Is that the same thing?
Almost exactly.
Almost. Anyway, those of you that want to go to this puppet festival, I thought I highlighted it, but evidently I didn't. It happens. Oh, I don't see a date. So. Thought I highlighted it. I didn't. This is me. But anyway, Puppet Fringe Festival. There is a article in the New York Times. You can find it by going to offstageonair.com. They'll have a link to it. It's written by Laurel Graber, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but which I may not be. Jake, you are a journalist, among other things, but we have an interesting... I thought it was the editor-in-chief, but it is actually the managing editor of American Theater Magazine. They have a new one. And I believe... Hold on, I may be... Oh, no, she's out of Atlanta. I almost thought she was Florida. But her name is Calundra Smith. She's the new managing editor of American Theater Magazine. Do y'all read American Theater Magazine?
Yeah.
Anybody?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're going back. We've talked about it on the show. They're going back to a print publication quarterly. So that's going to be really good. But American Theater Magazine is a program from Theater Communications Group, TCG. And she is indeed an Atlanta-based editor. So, Jake, what's the difference between a managing editor and editor-in-chief?
The editor-in-chief fields more of the angry phone calls than the managing editor does. But the managing editor is really the navigator of everything in the newsroom. So I worked in the main newsroom of one of the daily newspapers in South Florida for, I think, about 7 years. And the managing editor runs all the big meetings and is responsible for essentially the paper getting out and going to the press every day.
It's like the production stage manager.
Yeah, like the production stage manager.
Yeah, the editor-in-chief, real quick, is the public face of the paper. Usually the editor-in-chief
and
the publisher. No comment. No, they do. I've worked with some very good ones.
Yeah, so I found that interesting. And I do know that I believe the executive director just is stepping down at Theater Communications Group, so they'll be changing a lot of leadership, evidently. Here's an article that I'm just sad about, but it touches Texas, but this is out of Florida. The Hillsborough County, do y'all know where Hillsborough County is?
I believe that's Tampa.
Oh, it is Tampa. Actually, we talk about Tampa later. But the school district, because of that wonderful law, the anti-drag law, They are now, the school board has told them that they cannot teach full texts of Shakespeare. They can only do excerpts.
What?
And only the excerpts that are like standard B flat that don't have anything. Because Shakespeare was actually kind of raunchy.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of innuendo, lots of fun stuff.
Yeah. So that's, they've been, they can no longer do that.
Wow. Is that, did that news come out today? Because it's so hard to keep up with the insanity
happening. She said coming out of Florida, and I got scared.
Yeah. I think this just, this came out today from TampaBay.com is where I pulled it from. This is an article written by Marlene Sokol. I'm being really good about citing the articles because you're here. I don't always do that.
I love the byline mentions.
I'm not always good about doing that. But she says in the article, quote, there are ways that students can read these works in their entirety, district officials said. If a student can obtain a copy of one of these books or plays, perhaps with the help of their parents, they can do so.
Wow.
So the school is not even allowing them. I guess the complete works of Shakespeare is going to be banned in the school libraries.
Amazing.
I'm so confused that how even the most conservative of person can look at this law in its larger form and say it's a good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I get why they're afraid of drag and they're afraid of all this stuff. But I mean, these books have been around forever.
Yeah.
They're afraid of ideas, and you find ideas in books, so therefore they're afraid of books.
Right, but they are actually specifically targeting LGBTQ folks with this mostly. I mean, I don't think they banned Lolita, for instance.
So
I think it's, you know, the stuff around drag. And that leads us to here in Texas, because we have an anti-drag bill that is set to go into effect on September 1st. And the ACLU and a whole group of people, including the Vortex Theater here in Austin, are named as are suing the state to block the law. And it's done basically in, it's done, it's being brought for all these people by the ACLU in Houston. But it's the same basic, it's the same basic law. And it says, they can't have I'll just read this. It would ban real or simulated groping, real or simulated arousal, and the display of a sex toy if done in a prurient manner in front of a minor or a public property, and includes a definition of sexual conduct that bars the wearing of accessories or prosthetics that enhance the female or male form in front of a minor or public figure. So I guess you couldn't wear football shoulder pads, for instance.
Or a bra.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I do think that most of these laws that have come out around the country have met with lawsuits that have have stopped them from being enacted, but amazing. All right, we're about running out of time. I do want to just mention that Parade did close on Sunday, and that's it's sad. I mean, it's such a wonderful show. And then also I want to that Funny Girl, which is I think set to close next month, is going on tour. Austin is not on their itinerary. But if you want to go see it, you can go to Dallas or Houston. And then finally, real quick, like, I don't know, who likes the movie The Notebook? Anybody?
I've never seen it.
Oh, my God, you should see it. It's kind of a, kind of a chick flick. I like it. But anyway, it's going to Broadway with previews in February and opening in March, co-directed by Michael Greif and Sheil Williams. So that should be interesting. So that's it. So we're going to take a little break, and we are going to listen to a little bit of Parade, this is the duet towards the end called All the Wasted Time. We'll be right back. All the wasted time. We are back. You are listening to Offstage and On Air with me, Lisa Sheps. And we have a lovely guest here, which I am going to reintroduce right now, from Ground Floor Theater's production of Jenna and the Whale. We are so fortunate to have the playwrights of this show. Jake Klein, welcome.
Hello again.
And Vanessa Garcia.
Hi.
They are Miami playwrights, which we will hear about in just a moment. And then we have one of the performers, the illustrious and amazing Tony Knight.
Hello, hello.
And then we're actually also fortunate enough to have the director of Jenna and the Whale, Lisa Sheps.
Woo!
Thank you so much for having me, Lisa. You're welcome. I'm glad to be here. Vanessa or Jake, tell us about Jenna and the Whale. What is it? What's the show?
Go for it, Jake.
All right. Jenna and the Whale is a play set in a fictional Florida surf town, a small town on the beach, and it opens with a young woman finding herself inside the belly of a whale. She was out surfing in conditions in which no one should go surfing. We call it victory at sea. And if you go to the... I'll leave it there. I caught myself. Watch the rules. When she enters the whale, there is a man already inside the whale, and he introduces himself
as... typically is.
Always, yeah. Always inside whales.
And he introduces himself as Jonah.
So, cool. So it's the story of Jenna and the whale, as it says, and this goes on. But it's kind of a metaphor, right?
Yeah.
So tell us about the metaphor. Tell us what we would expect to see in this show.
So it's the story of a girl and a whale, but it's really about a town grappling with a very particular loss that happens in the town, and the whole idea of what that leaves behind and the kind of battles everybody faces through mourning, and the community coming together. So it's really, there are moments that are Jonah and the whale is a biblical story.
It is
a
indeed.
wacky little biblical story. And we have Jenna and her whale, which is, a little bit of a spinoff. She goes in with a surfboard and et cetera. But it's about bigger things. It's about, you start inside
a
whale.
It's something bigger than a whale?
Yeah. A blue.
The whale is a metaphor.
The biggest whale.
It's a lovely tale, and we don't stay in the whale the whole time.
No.
So we do visit the rest of the townsfolks of Dunes Beach, Florida.
I could tell you a little bit about one of the inspirations for the story.
I would love to hear that.
And if you may remember this, in 2014, there was a small town on the beach in Newfoundland, and a blue whale washed ashore, beached on that town. And to remove a whale from your beach is incredibly expensive. I believe it was like $80,000.
Really?
Yeah. You can't just push a whale back into the ocean. So as...
You could if you were Hercules.
You could, but I don't know that Hercules is in Newfoundland.
Just saying.
He's not accepting less than $82,000.
So as, often happens, the story went viral. There was a hashtag, has the whale exploded yet? There was a website made international news, because there was a fear that this whale, as it was decomposing, was going to explode. And I was fascinated by that. There's a line in the play of a character saying that she is marine life. So I'm like, I am marine life too. So I was really fascinated by the story, but I started thinking a lot about the people who lived in the town. All of a sudden, this international attention is on them because of this whale and the fear that the whale was going to explode.
So. Yeah, that is something. So talked about the research, and one of the first things that when you sent me the script, it had a link to an article about whales exploding and then also whale fall, which we talk about in the show. What's whale fall?
So whale fall is when a whale dies, but this is in the ocean. It sinks to the bottom of the ocean and it feeds generations and generations and generations of little sea creature life, communities.
Yeah.
Big ones, actually, it just for generations does that. And it's a beautiful thing because it's this mammoth of an animal that kind of, it's like that whole, to dust we shall return. I don't know what the bottom of the sea looks like, but it must be quite a sight.
Yeah. It must be. Yeah. And Tony, you are a performer in the show.
I am.
What are you playing?
I'm playing Rita Rodriguez, and she is the, I don't know how much to say about my character, but she is one of the people in the community who is grappling with the loss that's revealed. And it's a whole journey through the play, like her emotions and where she ends up and where the town ends up. It's kind of a beautiful, to me, I mean, it's a real healing play, like, sure. And especially, you know, where it all ends, it's pretty magical.
And one of the things that I like, and I'll just, you know, put on my director hat for a moment, because I did direct this piece. You know, we look at this piece, it's very metaphorical, but Rita and her family run a surf shack. And that is kind of the anchor for the production. It's steeped in realism, and everything else is kind of metaphorical.
Yeah.
So in this play, it's you and your daughter that are there.
That's right. Yeah. Running the surf shack and dealing with, you know, the what happens when the whale shows up.
Yeah. So how was it working on this show? Were you mistreated in any way?
Only by the director. everyone else was fantastic. The director. what was that blog again? I'm just going to.
So I will say, because we'll be saying it right up front, when we talk about loss, we're dealing with the subject of suicide. Mm-hmm. That's an important piece to know, because we want to make sure that people are prepared when they come in to see the show that we're talking about that. So when we talk about loss of suicide and then the healing of the community that comes around that, it's actually really a beautiful story. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of positivity around it. Can y'all talk at all about like the impetus to write this piece?
Well, I will say that Jake and I met because, one of the producers on this, Willie Fernandez, introduced us. He kept saying, you guys should all meet each other. You should meet each other. You should meet each other. And we were just kind of like, okay, in our own worlds, I feel like, you know. And then we ended up meeting up at a bar, which at the time was called The Mighty, that happened to be our neighborhood bars at different times.
Oh, interesting.
So, yeah, I was like, why hadn't we seen each other here, you
right,
know?
Right.
And right away, Jake started talking about, because, you know, you're like two writers, dorky, and you're like, what are you working on? I asked Jake, and he was saying you had a novella.
I had I was working on two novellas and a short play. And the short play had been written. And the short play was about a man and a woman inside the belly of a whale.
Right.
But I should say that I was completely nervous about pitching this idea to Vanessa. We talked for 2 hours about all kinds of things, and then the whole time I was thinking she's going to think this is just nutty
at all. So like he's talking, and all of the stories had different elements, and I like in my brain was just joining them in different ways, and I was like, God, I hope he doesn't hate what I'm doing in my head right now. You know, like just joining different things. So I think it was right. I don't know if I sent you a text or an email.
You sent me I woke up to an email and you braided all those ideas together. And I remember just going, wow, yes, here we are. This is it.
And we wrote a synopsis. And then we were like, okay, characters. And at first we were like, well, okay, you do the male characters and I'll do the female characters. That ended super fast because there's a lot of women. So then we just started writing on a Google Doc, and we did this thing where I was working on another show that would end really late, and I would come home and needed to like decompress, and I would work on this, and then I would hand it to him and he would work in the mornings. So we were just like working on Jenna and the Whale like that, and it was so smooth.
Yeah, right? I think we completed the first draft in 6 weeks, I believe. Wow.
Well, it's a beautiful piece. I know, interestingly enough, you know, Willie Fernandez brought y'all together, but Willie Fernandez also brought us together.
Yes.
Because he was the one that sent the script to me. And then both me and my co-artistic director, Patty, who has been guest host here on Offstage and on the Air, fought over who would direct it, and I won. So that's good. You know, I get a lot of questions from people going, Jenna and the Whale, is this show all about the Bible?
No.
Tell us, is it biblical in nature, the show?
No. There are a number of allusions to the Bible and biblical language because, you know, it's unavoidable when you have a character named Jonah, who is living inside of a whale.
For 3 days.
Three years, yes.
Sorry.
For me, and it's funny because Vanessa and I, we connected so well and so deeply on this that we just wrote this play and that didn't talk a lot of it out. So in the past couple of years, some of these things, we're having these conversations for the first time. So I don't think that I've ever talked about this with Vanessa, but for me, when having gone through a loss and biblical language, which is kind of a common, right? It's a common language, it's part of our regular everyday vernacular, comes up. And that's when you're talking about your loss to somebody, they could be religious and that's where they go. And that's a tool that they used that they think will help you heal, whether you or a believer or not. And there are characters in the play. There's at least one who is a believer and feels that way. Mm-hmm. So that was just something I wanted to weave into the play because it's part of biblical language. Faith is part of the language of grief.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that I would add to that is, I mean, I grew up and went to an all-girl Catholic school. So like these stories are in me and inside, you know, but I also see the Bible as a living piece of literature that has to continuously change and adapt and be interpreted and be read. And so like, you know, there are a ton of metaphors that nod back to those stories, which are super rich and amazing, you know? And I think the relationship that each of the characters has to those stories is very interesting and what that means. So,
right. So I will say the play does not preach at you. So that's an important thing to say. So, and I'd also say that this is probably, in terms of who you could bring, I would call it a PG-13, but it would definitely bring up, you know, it's all dependent on how comfortable you are talking to your kids because it will bring up questions. So that's that. So when does this show open, you guys?
Friday.
Friday is opening.
Thursday, tomorrow, is our first preview.
Yeah.
And where can folks go to get more information, or should I just tell them?
groundfloortheater.org.
/Jenna. Or you can just like go. We're right there on the homepage. So, and it plays through August 26th for 3 weeks, Thursday through Sunday. So I'm so happy to have y'all on, and me as well. We're going to go to break and we're going to come back and we're going to learn a little bit more about Vanessa and Jake after we talk about some local stuff. So don't go away. You have been listening to Vanessa Garcia, Jake Klein, Tony Knight, and Lisa Sheps, all of Ground Floor Theater's Jenna and the Whale, opening or playing August 10th through 26th. For more information, groundfloortheater.org. And this is an interesting song from a show called The Islander, and it's called There Is a Whale. We'll be right back.
There is a whale.
Bruise blue on the bone white coral.
We are back. You're listening to Offstage and on the Air with Lisa Sheps. I just wanted to follow. We talked here during the break, Tony, a little bit, just about we know that this show deals with the subject of suicide, but we don't see suicide, right?
No, there's no dramatization of that. It's really more about it's an event in the past, and that is, you know, the world of the play takes place long after that event.
Sure.
But it's really about how, you know, difficult it is to process grief and the various stages of that.
Yep, that's what it's about. So I thought that was important to clear up, or you thought it was important to clear up, and I agreed with you. It so rarely happens. Let's just take a second to talk about what's going on here locally. We were going to talk to Brian Cheslett, get some details about the Laramie Project, which is coming to Ground Floor Theater from September 7th through 16th with Def Austin Theater. And I know they've got really incredible things, like Judy Shepard is coming to see the show. So that's pretty amazing for the Laramie Project. Have y'all seen the Laramie Project before?
I have not.
No.
I haven't either.
Well, y'all will have to fly back in to see that here at Ground Floor Theater.
I will be.
It should be very, very interesting. And ASL is such a beautiful language. We've done it. We've worked with it at Ground Floor Theater several times, along with Deaf Austin Theater. There is a 1-day showing on the 12th of August at the Vortex called "The Black Feminist Guide to the Human Body." It's written by Lisa B. Thompson, who we just love, love, love. Lisa is just the grand dame of Austin theater writing scene. It's actually somebody you would love to meet. She's done a lot of plays, and she actually did her directing debut at Ground Floor Theater, and we did Coleman Domingo's Dot. But this is a one-night-only stage reading of a choreo poem by Lisa. It's directed by Rudy Ramirez, who will be our co-host next week.
Yay.
So that's good. And it features Nadine Mazan, who I just love, Haley Armstrong, and Sade Jones. And Sade is also the movement director. I just love everything that Lisa B. Thompson does. And this is a reading. It's going to be fully full production in conjunction with Fusebox Festival in April of 2024.
Exciting.
So I think you can get information about that at the Vortex website, which is vortexrep.org. Other things playing here in town. I'm going to go through the list. We've got lots of stuff. Matilda is still out at Zilker till the 12th. Small Steps by the Shrewds playing at Hyde Park also to the 12th. I believe Summer Stock Austin is still going through the 12th. You can go to impactart.org to find out whether it's Grease or Wizard of Oz or what's going on there. God of Carnage, who was a guest here on the show, is happening at the Rosette Theater through August 13th. Magnolia Musical Theater, who was our guest last week, is also playing through the 13th out in Bee Caves. Jenna and the Whale at Ground Floor Theater is August 10th through 26th. Zach, Head Over Heels, they open today. Is today the 9th? Yeah, they open today, August 9th through November 10th. And 9 to 5, which just got a really positive review in Broadway World, is happening at TexArts out in Lakeway, and they play through the 27th of August. There
Amazing.
You go. Anything other? Did I miss anything that you know of?
No, I think you've got the list. I was checking off like, oh, okay, what will I be able to watch?
And I'm guessing y'all don't have any local stuff. But do y'all have anything happening in Miami that y'all are doing?
Yeah, stuff coming up. Do you have anything?
Personally, I do not.
Okay.
I have a show that I also co-wrote in Miami that's going to happen at Actors Playhouse called Sweet Goats and Blueberry Senoritas, which I co-wrote with Richard Blanco, who was Obama's inaugural poet.
Oh my God. I think I read that. Yeah, that's amazing. Well, we're going to get more information about all that after we take a little break. Today in theater history, there's not a lot happened, but there are some birthdays.
Whose birthday?
I'm going to tell you. Brandon Espinoza, George Stiles, P.L. Travers. She was born in 1899. She looks good for Amazing. Being almost 100 years, over 100 years
quite
old.
Quite fresh, yeah.
Melanie Griffith and Anna Kendrick.
All right. I knew the last two.
Yeah, me too. I have to say that I just love Anna Kendrick to death.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of hers, and she was actually got nominated for a Tony in the mid-90s when she was just a toddler. And I looked on YouTube. She did High Society, Cole Porter, on Broadway. She was the only one, I think she was 8 or 9 years old.
Oh my gosh.
She was the only one in that show that got nominated.
Wow.
We're going to hear a little song from hers right now, but it's a cut from a YouTube clip. It's like a 6-minute clip and shows her acting. She's what a precocious, adorable child she was, and has a great voice and a beautiful French accent. And High Society looks like such a fun show. And it was, it's not done all that often. It had a Broadway in the 90s, and it was in the West End. And then I think it's got something happening relatively soon. But let's just take a moment and listen to Anna Kendrick singing I Love Paris from High Society.
Yay.
We will be right back.
I love Paris in the springtime.
We are back. You're listening to Offstage and On Air with Lisa Sheps. We've had lovely conversations with Tony Knight, Jake Klein, and Vanessa Garcia. And now we're going to switch gears. We're all still here. We're not going anywhere, right?
No, I mean, probably not.
Well, not for another 10 minutes. We have 10 more minutes. But I wanted to talk to you guys about your journey as playwrights. And then we can explore a little bit of the process. Now, Jake, your background is in journalism.
Correct.
I don't want to, boost your ego or anything, but you're a Pulitzer winner.
Yes.
In case you didn't know.
I heard about it, yes. Yeah, my final year at the South Florida Sun Sentinel, the paper where I worked for a number of years, February 14, 2018, was the...
Valentine's Day.
Yes, it was the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. And the high school was in the newspaper's backyard, so we covered it every day. And we won the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service, which is considered the gold medal. But, of course, we all would do anything to give it back and have not covered that story.
That was such a tragic story, and we were all afterwards kind of hopeful that something might be done about the rash of gun violence. And, of course, we know now that we didn't.
No,
So thank you for covering that. I didn't mean to make light of it at the end. I did not know. I was not.
You did not know that's where I was going.
I did not know. So,
no.
So that was that's incredible. What kind of journal? Writer, news editor? I don't know. I don't know what.
I did everything at that point. I was in features. I was a features editor, not the features editor, but. We responded quickly the week of the shooting, the day of the shooting, and we divided the newsroom into teams. So the team that I led was the team that focused on the families, the survivors, the students, and that quickly morphed into the March for Our Lives movement because that movement formed immediately.
Yep.
Yeah.
So
very
a
quickly.
Project that my team produced was one of the winners of the Pulitzer.
Yeah, oh, amazing. And how did you find yourself into playwriting?
So I left at the end of 2018, and Willie Fernandez was a managing editor at the Sun Sentinel.
We're going to have a drinking game here at Offstage on the Air. Every time Willie Fernandez is mentioned, we're going to take a drink.
So I worked with Willie. He was a great friend at the paper, a great mentor. And I also write fiction short stories. And probably about 6 months, 7 months after I left the paper, I hadn't talked to Willie in a little bit. He called to just check in and ask me what I was working on because I was living gloriously on severance for quite some time. And I told him I just finished this story that I've been working on for about a year. And I sent it to him. And long story short, he read it that night. The next day, he called me and said, if you turn this story into a play, I'll produce it.
Oh,
and
wow.
I accepted that challenge and wrote the play.
What was that play?
It's called Purple Hearts.
Okay. And is it about veterans?
It concerns veterans, yes. It's a family drama, and we've had a couple of readings.
Great. No productions then. Yet.
No productions
okay.
yet.
Okay, well, that'll happen. And Vanessa, you've been playwriting for a while. As a matter of fact, your show, Amparo, longest running show in Miami, is that?
Well, yeah, I don't know if it was the longest running, but it ran a long time and things don't usually run very long in Miami.
No.
It was supposed to run for 2 months, something like that, or not even. And it ran for 8 months straight, but it was insane. It was a wild ride.
And it was, I did not do any research, so forgive me. It was an immersive piece?
Yeah, it was completely immersive. It took place in a villa, in a big house, two floors, a whole garden in the back, which we called the rum garden. And there were 23 different ways to see this piece. You could go back 23 different times and it would be different. There were five entry points. The script the actors when they first saw it. The director had warned me. She was like, the actors are going to freak out when they see the script. Oh, like, yeah. I need to change the script. And I was like, no, they'll be fine. And they were like, what language is this in? Because it's just like columns everywhere where they intersected and the stories. It was a lot of storylines going on at the same time. And you kind of had to, you know, get them all moving.
Yeah, that's got to be really fascinating. I heard a podcast talking about, oh my God, I just forgot the name of the show, Sleep No More in New York. Yeah. And talking about how it happened. And it's got to be a kind of similar thing where you've got to trace everything out.
And, yep. You have to like run them in your head. And the one difference, and I kept saying this with this show, was that, you know, like the British model of immersive is very non-narrative. It's very movement based. And like, I definitely wanted this to be narrative, which is, it ended up being harder. So I gave myself a nice little task, but it was a lot of fun.
But I approve. I'm very fond of narrative things. So tell us how you got into playwriting. We only have like just two or three minutes left.
The short version.
Yeah.
The short version is I was writing novels, you know, like I was in my early 20s and they all ended up in a drawer, you know, but except for one later. But all my friends were actors and directors, and they were like, hey, why don't you write something for me so that I could direct it? Hey, why don't you write something for me so that I can act in it? Hey, what? So I started writing plays, and they were like, these are better than your novel.
Oh, my.
Oh. All right. And that was my sister. I will say, to her credit, so she doesn't kill me later, she's also the biggest fan of the novel when it eventually came out. So, Nikki, don't kill me. But, yeah, they were actors and directors, and I wrote for them, and it was so rewarding, and it was something that was like, this was writing with not just yourself in a room and a computer, you know.
What was the name of the first piece? The first
Parked
play.
Parked was the first thing I wrote, and it was about something, two architects, and they're arguing. They've just been given this feat of like creating this building in a place where everything else has failed.
Everything.
And then, you know, it was literally right after 9/11, so everybody called it a 9/11
sure.
piece. But it's not, you know, it never mentions 9/11 or anything.
Well, that is amazing. In like just 30 seconds, is there anything that y'all can tell us about the future? What you've got in the pipeline?
Coco and the Shark. It's a sequel to Jenna and the Whale.
That's probably
I've
probably
been making
really
that
good.
Joke since I got here, but I'm starting to get serious about it.
We love it. Sequel. We'll produce it at Ground Floor Theater. You have anything, Vanessa?
We're gonna keep working together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're
for
definitely
sure.
gonna keep
well,
working together.
Well, you do such a good job together. I love that. Yeah. If people wanted to find out more about each of you, do y'all have websites or anything you'd like to tell folks about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You go.
Okay. Instagram, Vanessa Garcia Writer, and my website is vanessagarcia.org.
And Jake? I'm at jakeklein.net, and I'm on Instagram, but I honestly don't know my handle.
Great. Tony, do you have a website?
I do not.
Okay. I cut you off. Were you going to say something else? No, I thought
it was,
but
I forgot.
Okay, never mind. Okay, well, thank you all so much for being on the show. Just as a reminder, folks, Ground Floor Theater's Jen and the Whale opens tomorrow, Thursday, the 10th, in place for the 26th. More information, groundfloortheater.org. Tony, Jake, Vanessa, thank you so much for being on Offstage and on the Air. I'm so thrilled to have y'all here.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to take a little break, and we're just in celebration of Miami. This is from Sugar. And it's about Miami. We'll be right back. We are back. You're listening to Offstage and on the Air with Lisa Sheps. We stream this live at KOOP.org. I was so happy to have everybody on the show and talk about Jenna and the Whale and playwriting in general, which is such a mystery to me. You wouldn't think it'd be because I'm kind of in the business. But
nightmare.
Whoops. God, that song just wants to play, doesn't it? So thank y'all for joining us on Offstage and on the Air. We are going to stand by for the Cooperative Hour. This week, it's my dear friend Robert Sims and Lights Camera Austin. And we're going to go away listening to a little of Raise a Little Hell from Bonnie and Clyde, the Frank Wildhorn musical that just released this cast album. We'll see you next week when we look at what's happening off stage and on the air. Bye, everybody.
This nightmare has to end in this godforsaken place. Death would be a welcome friend.